This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Today we're showcasing a compilation of three short news features produced by JPR's award-winning news team and other newsrooms from across our region. There are over 1,000 tide gates in Oregon. They keep the ocean from flooding agricultural land, but many tide gates were installed more than 70 years ago, and now they're at risk of failure. As JPR's Justin Higginbottom reports, replacing them isn't easy.
Fred Messerly's family has made their living off the land along the southern Oregon coast for seven generations. Today, he's standing near a newly built tide gate that spans Palouse Creek next to a road in Coos County. On one side of the street is an inlet of Coos Bay. On the other side are grazing sheep, totally oblivious to the effort it took to keep their pasture above water.
I don't know if you can see there, see where the mud line is on that. When that water gets up to that point, then that float will lift, and that will mechanically trigger these gates so that they'll close.
A tide gate is like a big door on a river or creek that feeds into the ocean. High tide will push the door closed, protecting pastures and crops from salt water. When water recedes during low tide, the door swings open, letting fresh water drain into the ocean. This tide gate was built last year.
There's four 10-foot wide gates in this structure.
State-of-the-art in terms of tide gates. Coos County has about a third of all tide gates in Oregon. Most were put in around 70 years ago, quickly and cheaply, so that families like the Messerlys could grow crops. But times have changed, and things are no longer quick or cheap.
We were working for, well, almost over 30 years to try to get a new structure built.
Haley Lutz, executive director at the Coos Watershed Association, says a reason for this is a daunting regulatory process.
There's like anywhere from 9 to 11 agencies involved in permitting a single tide gate upgrade. It's a big multi-jurisdictional problem.
The site of a tide gate can include confusing overlays of private, state, and county land. Policymakers formed the Oregon Tide Gate Partnership to streamline the process, but it's still hard. Another issue is the cost. Back in the day, tide gates were less expensive.
When they were put in, a lot of them at the same time, they were way cheaper. You know, they just put in a massive, heavy top hinge slab of wood, and now you're seeing things that are much more expensive.
That tide gate on Palouse Creek took around $3 million to build, paid for by state conservation grants. There are also more regulations meant to help fish, like the endangered coho salmon, move through these waterways. Allison Tarbox, a project manager with the Coos Watershed Association, says fish traveling downstream can be harmed if tide gates don't open wide enough.
Have you ever put your thumb over like the end of a hose and you see that velocity just kind of spray out and around? It kind of does that whenever it pushes open.
She says as the structures age, it's more likely they won't work properly, putting fish at risk. And the situation is getting pretty dire.
Since they were all kind of installed at the same time, they're all kind of failing all at the same time.
Climate change makes those tide gates even more crucial. Scientists predict that waters will rise at least 3 feet along the Oregon coast in the next 80 years. Fred Messerly explains that flooding due to a failing tide gate isn't only a problem for farmers.
Here, there's a mile and a half of county road that would be subject to flooding on the high tides in the wintertime. You wouldn't be able to get to work or get home again.
That could impact emergency services and inundate lowland buildings. The frustrating thing for Messerly is that they have a solution to it all, to protect fish, agriculture, and infrastructure.
We've learned so much in the last 20, 30 years that to say that we can't do it and protect all of our stakeholders, we just can't say that anymore.
Those stakeholders just need lots of money and to get through lots of regulations. Messerly says Coos County and its tide gates can't wait another 3 decades. Justin Higginbottom, JPR News.
The Chinook Indian Nation of Southwest Washington has been trying to get federal recognition from the U.S. government since the mid-90s. As OPB's Eric Newman reports, recently they started looking for a new champion in Washington, D.C.
When Tony Johnson walks the beach at Bay Center, a small peninsula that hooks north in Washington's Willapa Bay, he feels connected to both the past and the present. The beach, Johnson Beach, is named for his grandfather. Photos exist that are very old and tie the tribe to the land. Today, it's where members dig for clams and gather oysters.
hard to describe exactly what the compulsion is. It's just being on our place.
Johnson is the chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation. He's leading the effort to get them federal recognition from the U.S. government. That status could bring real benefits to the tribe, like educational grants and local health care services.
A recognized Chinook would have a police force that could take a telephone call. It would have a social services program that could respond to the moment.
But they recently hit a speed bump in the process when they reached an impasse with their congressional representative, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. The Democrat has been sponsoring legislation for the tribe, but she recently proposed language that would limit their hunting, fishing, and other natural resource rights. In a region where fishing and oyster aquaculture are a big part of the economy, Glusenkamp-Perez says there are concerns about what tribal recognition could mean for local businesses.
You know, from the fishing and the shellfish aquaculture community, folks need clarity. They need to know what the impacts on their lives will be, their family businesses.
Other local tribes also gave lukewarm support for Chinook recognition. In a statement, Cowlitz Tribe Chairman William B. Ayell said, quote, "We wish the Chinook people success in demonstrating their connection to the Chinook homelands, lands of modern-day Pacific County, as they pursue federal recognition." The Quinault Indian Nation did not respond to an interview request, and the chairman of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, Dolores Pigsley, said in a statement that their tribal council has had numerous conversations with the Chinook Indian Nation group. She said they remain open to continued dialogue about their proposal. Meeting the requirements for tribal recognition under the Bureau of Indian Affairs is difficult, says Robert Miller. He's a law professor at Arizona State University and a member of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe.
What is hard is that these BIA requirements demand that you prove you and your families have somehow remained sort of a separate and recognized by the community tribal group over 150 years. When the United States has been trying to assimilate and destroy tribal communities, and of course, Native peoples have dispersed.
Since the Bureau of Indian Affairs declined to recognize the Chinook in 2001, their best odds now would be through an act of Congress. That's why they need a champion like Glusenkamp-Perez. The lawmaker says the Chinook being unrecognized is a historical wrong that needs to be righted.
And that means a bill that can garner that support. We need the broadest level of support from stakeholders here at home to be able to reach 218 votes in the House and pass the Senate and become a law.
For now, her draft legislation has not been introduced in Congress. Before doing that, she says it needs more support from local fisheries businesses and neighboring tribes. Johnson says the Chinook Nation doesn't have any plans to open a business in Bay Center.
What Chinook's resource access looks like in the future is to be determined. But what Chinook can't do is accept having this, you know, across the board stripped from us.
He says Chinook people want to protect their rights for water, hunting, and gathering as central parts of their culture. And he says that culture has always been there.
It's like somebody walked out the door and said, "That sky is not blue." For us, it is that straightforward. The sky is blue. The Chinook Indian Nation is here, not going anywhere, and has always been here.
Johnson says for the time being, the tribe is keeping all options open and looking for support from all members of Oregon and Washington's congressional delegations. I'm Eric Newman reporting.
Drive into Yaquina Bay State Park in Newport, and in the middle of the road stands a beautiful Sitka spruce overlooking the ocean. For generations, people have gotten married next to it, taking graduation pictures beneath it, and otherwise just appreciated the beloved 150-year-old tree. But as Christian Foden-Vinsel reports, it's now diseased, and the Parks Department is asking what to do with it.
The tree is known as the muscle tree because of the way its beefy branches stick out, like a bodybuilder flexing his arms. Newport Gallery manager Ashley Berger says it's beautiful.
I think it's such an iconic part of the park. To drive around it is so special.
But Oregon State Parks arborist Catherine Carlton says recently it sprouted a big red and yellow flat mushroom.
So this park ranger saw these fruiting bodies notified me, and then we had a major storm event. Surprise, it's the Oregon coast. It was windy here, especially at this location, and that limb had failure because of a decay pocket caused by the disease.
A massive branch broke off, and if a car had been underneath, it could have been fatal. Carlton recognized the fungus as Dyer's polypore, so called because it can be crushed for use as a natural dye. It's also known as velvet top.
It's also commonly called a cow pie fungus because when it dies back, it turns a dark brown, almost black color that kind of looks like a cow patty.
Cow pie fungus, Dyer's polypore, or velvet top. The point is the mussel tree's dying from a fungus called Phaeolus schwinnitzii. It gets into the roots and spreads upwards, rotting the wood until the tree can no longer stand under its own weight. Carlton drilled some core samples to see how much healthy wood remains in the mussel tree and found just 12%, so something needs to be done. But because it's so beloved, the Parks Department didn't want to just cut it down. Instead, they set up a website asking for suggestions.
Creating a cool wood sculpture from the base of the tree, depending on how much decay is in there, that might not actually work. Another option is to chop it down completely. And then another option that we're working through is donate the logs to a local watershed association to provide a habitat for fish.
Another suggestion is to create a big slice of the tree with markers indicating what was happening while each of the approximately 150 annual tree rings were growing. Landscape designer Eileen Stark came across the mussel tree while surfing the web and thinks the best option is to chop off the branches and create a snag, that is, a dead or dying tree that's still standing.
Small mammals, reptiles, amphibians like tree frogs, even some butterflies will roost under loose bark, as well as bats.
If you think of a big old log in the forest, the amount of wildlife and plants that can grow on them is astounding. Stark says the same is true of a snag.
Snags are, they're considered upright, still standing. If you put the log on the ground, then it's a log.
Stark says few people understand the value of a snag. They tend to either want to see a full, healthy tree or to cut a diseased tree down to make way for a new one. But she says snags are invaluable because soft, decaying wood can easily be dug out by a woodpecker or amphibian to make a home, and that home is up high off the ground where it's safer and drier. Snags happen naturally by disease, lightning, drought, and old age, but historically, humans haven't been that appreciative.
I think it's mostly an aesthetic thing. People think dead and dying trees don't look nice. They want to have a nice, vibrant one in place, but they are just absolutely, it's vital to wildlife. They're just essential and full of life, and their protection is crucial. And there's a real huge shortage of snags.
It's a hard decision.
Burke Martin is park manager at Yuquina Bay and one of the main people to decide about the mussel tree.
The intention was is not to just to make a bigger paved area. We're trying to figure out a way to make an area where people can remember the tree, that it was there, and leave it as a habitat tree to provide another resource for other animals and things to create homes in.
At about 150 years old, the mussel tree has watched over Newport since about the time it became a seaside resort and was officially named Newport. A decision on the future of the tree is expected next month. I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel reporting.
I'm Mike Green. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more. Or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.